It is very good to be here. Very good to see everyone. I'm going to break another one of those speaking rules because I'm going to start off with an apology. Everyone, it felt like dozens who had come up to us while we were working down in the south booth, and they're smiling, and there's, oh, it's nice to see you, and we're serious, and we're getting, you know, working on problems, and I felt terrible. I felt like a cold fish, but no, it was good to see you. I hate not having the time, but there's a lot of hard work going on trying to get this. And if you were here day one, you know there was a lot of work going on. But they have finished, you know, I think we've solved most of our problems and things are going smoothly. And I know it's said, it's often repeated, but it really is a privilege to work with the people here. You know what it's like at work, because where I work, when problems like this come up, someone's at each other's throat, and they're swearing and cursing and blaming, and just it's a good group of people to work with. So it really is a privilege, and this has been a great week. For those who don't know me too well, you're probably telling yourself, he's got a normal-sized head. If you went to the website, the CFN website, and looked at the, you know, we have little headshots, my head was 3 times larger than everybody else's. I don't know why. But when I first opened it up, I thought, Charlie Brown is speaking at the feast this year. I was looking forward to that. But Lisa did tell me, my wife, she did the, you know, the announcements that we have up here before and after church. There's a slide, and she told me, I shrank your head down to normal size. I thought, isn't that what a good wife does? All right, I want to take you to your favorite detective show. Murder mystery, help, you know, whatever genre you enjoy, but there are a ton of them on TV. I know there's one of them that we watch, and they come up with the most creative ways to kill people. You know, there is one show we watch, it's on in syndication, there's probably at least 100 episodes, and I hate to say it, one will come on, you know, it's about in the afternoon, we get home from work, we're getting ready for dinner, and all we have to do is see the opening murder scene, and then we know which episode it is. Because each one is unique. But I want to, I know you're probably thinking to yourself, ooh, this is a gruesome way to start up a sermon. But the scene is they find a body and there's a knife stuck in the back. And of course, our brilliant detective can deduce so much from this. And what I want to talk about is just that idiom that we use, being stabbed in the back. Because when we use it, 99.99% of the time, it's not literal, okay? We're talking, but there's a lot of meaning, and it's the literal meaning that, you know, it's the literal that gives it the meaning. To be stabbed in the back, to be betrayed, we know when that happens, if an enemy were to attack us, we're face to face. We got our arms up, we're grappling, we're punching, we're kicking. If we turn our back, it's because we're around someone we trust. When we expose our back to someone, it's because we trust them. They're a friend. We would never show an enemy our weakness. And there are few things that will cause us as much pain as being betrayed. You know, when someone you trust, someone you love maybe, betrays you, they turn on you. You know, I mean, you can think at work, you know, one of your coworkers takes your idea, takes it as his own. He gets the credit, gets the big promotion, maybe starts his own company. You know, you have a friend that turns you into the authorities. And, oh, and this could be in third grade. You know, your best friend tells on you because you grabbed one of the cookies or one of the candies from the jar when you weren't supposed to. And probably the one everybody dreads, your spouse leaves you for somebody else. And it happens. It is so common. You know, it's a common condition in the human existence that when Jesus came, when he came here to offer himself as a sacrifice, in his suffering, in that final night, he was betrayed. He experienced betrayal. One of his disciples, one close to him, betrayed him. And they did it the way he did it, not with an accusation, not with an attack. They did it with a kiss, you know, with an expression of affection and caring. And, you know, betrayal can be the source of bitterness that people carry for long into their life. Now, we know this. We know we are vulnerable. We know that there are ways people can hurt us. And so we find ways to protect ourselves, don't we? We have a few more idioms, things that we say, things we never experience, but we know what they mean. Because if you've watched old Westerns, we know what it means to circle the wagons, right? Okay, back with the cowboys and Indians, you know, the bandits would be attacking them. And I won't say Indians because, you know, that's not politically correct. We all know it was Indians. But it's a sound tactic. You're under attack, so you circle up. And what happens when you do that? Everybody's facing the enemy. Everyone's back is turned to a friend. So everyone's covering somebody else's back. It's a sound tactic. You know, you're maneuvering yourself, you know, so that you're not vulnerable. And maybe you don't have enough to circle, but we know what the phrase fighting back to back means. You know, you're up against the wall. You got a whole lot of enemies. There's just two of you. So you turn. I'll take this way. You take that way. And it's an expression of desperation, because usually we're in that situation, you're surrounded, but you're going to stand and fight together. If one of you leaves, if one of you decides, here's my chance, there's an opening, I'm going to go, both of you now are vulnerable, because now you've left both of your backs exposed. Now, armies understand this. Now, I'll tell you now, I have no military training at all, but I have read a few books. And in this day and age, that makes me an expert. Wikipedia can make experts of anyone. But when armies are moving, they're vulnerable. When they are stationary, you know, they can dig the trenches. They can put up the fortifications. You know, they can have all their plans in preparation for the attack. But it's when they have to move. It's when, you know, the enemy is coming and attacking the borders. They got to move out and meet them. Then they know they're vulnerable. They're vulnerable to ambush. You know, they can step right into a trap. They are vulnerable of being flanked, where they're moving forward, the enemy comes around, and they strikes at their side and strike at their rear. Because at the back of the army, that's usually where your supplies, your communication, where your medics or where your wounded are. And so they are quite vulnerable to an attack. They're also in danger during a retreat. And it does happen. You attack, it's not working, you got to pull back and regather. And what happens when you pull back? You have to turn your back to your enemy. And so to do so, they make themselves easy targets. And for centuries, and I'm sure that there are many armies who have done otherwise, but it's kind of a classic move to split your force into three bodies. Because you have your main force. You have your force that has the majority of your fighting men, it has your food, it has your supplies, has your ammunition, has all the things to go forward, and they can fight for many days. But they will also send out a vanguard. You know, this is a highly mobile, quick strike force. It's one, their purpose is to go out, scope out the enemy, find where they are, and clear or secure a staging area so that main army can come up. And if you're like me, when I hear that definition, I think of D-Day. I think of storming the beaches of Normandy when they knew the enemy held the coastline. And they had to get there quickly, push the enemy off the beach so they can bring in their main force and not be under fire the whole time. Dangerous job. And, you know, if you know the stories and if you know someone who's been there, a lot of casualties because it's rough. And you are under fire and your job is to clear out the enemy. You don't have the main force at your back. You're there alone. And besides the vanguard, you would have something called the rear guard. And this was, it's more of a reserve force, but its job is to guard your side, to guard your back. When the army moves forward, it makes sure you don't get surprised. It doesn't make sure you have, you know, the enemy has hidden a force somewhere and comes up and jumps out from behind. You know, it's their job also to remove the threat of a surprise attack. But when that main army has to retreat, they come in. They ride in, they engage that enemy, keep that army, you know, locked down in battle so that the main force can back up, can retreat. Now, when you do that, there's no backup for them. So again, it's a very dangerous job. You've got to be quick, got to know what you're doing. Without a rear guard, a retreat can very quickly be every man for himself. And if you've read any accounts of the Revolutionary War, as proud as we are of our Minutemen, sometimes when battle wasn't going their way, they drop their weapons and run. Because your only defense when you're retreating is speed. You just move as fast as you can. Armies don't last very long in this condition. And it takes discipline and training to keep an army together. And they'll have to trust each other. Often, you know, they have to learn, if I don't stay at my post, someone may die for it. So they have to work together successfully. And without trust, it might be every man for himself. Now, there's a principle here, a military principle of all things. But we find it in Scripture, because I want you to turn to Exodus 14. And it is sound tactics, but there's something that goes beyond that. And I want to jump into the story. You have, you know, well-known, you know, that we probably grew up learning these passages, the children of Israel, through the many plagues, the miracles, God pulled them out of Egypt, and here they are on the road, Moses is leading them, and then they get to a sea. And they turn around, and they realize there's an army behind them, and then there's the sea in front of them. And picking up in verse 13, "But Moses said to the people, 'Do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish before you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent.' Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. As for you, lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the sons of Israel shall go on through the midst of the dry land.'" So this is one of the great miracles of the Bible, right? This is an iconic moment. We have all learned this story. Probably, even if we grew up in a house that wasn't very religious and didn't go to church, everybody knows about going through the Red Sea. Moses leading the children of Israel as the sea opens up, they walk through on dry ground. But God seems surprised here. "Why are you crying out to me? What are you doing here?" You know, as if it's, you know, raise up your hand, part the sea, and go. I'll fight for you. I'll be there. "Why are you crying?" you said. And if you looked at the verses before, they were crying. They got there, oh, free at last. They were happy. It was out of Egypt. Everything's great. And then they realize, ooh, we have nowhere to go. We have an angry army behind us. And quickly, "Why did you lead us out here?" Didn't take very long. They were crying. They weren't moving forward. And this is something that, you know, God was a little, you know, almost indignant. "What are you doing here? Go, go." Just look in verse 19. "The angel of God who had been going before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel. And there was the cloud along with the darkness, and it gave light at night. And thus did one not come near the other all night long." That cloud, it was a cloud in the day, it was a pillar of fire at night that followed them. It led them. It was going to lead them to the promised land. It moved. It was in the front. It moved to the back. And it engaged that army of Pharaoh so that they could retreat. It was a rear guard action. He covered their retreat. It was a classic military move. Now, God was going to lead them out of slavery and into freedom. And this was a physical journey, but it was also a spiritual journey. And while he led them, he said, "I'm going to watch your back. You know, don't just stand here. Keep moving. I've got this." Now, the journey took a whole lot longer than the physical journey needed to, because it was more than just walking from point A to point B. It was a spiritual journey as well. There was a trust that God was trying to instill them. "Trust me. I'm going to be there. Go where I tell you to go, and I'll be there for you." You know, it required a trust that would not come easily for them, because if you read through, especially the next couple books, you get there in the promise, before they even get to the promised land, they didn't trust God. And even when they're in the promised land, that you just have one cycle after the other. When they trust God, they flourished. They won their battles. When they didn't, they didn't. Now, we have a message that God had been trying to tell his people for centuries. Keep going forward. Trust me. I've got your back. Now, several centuries later, there was a prophet that was sent to Israel. They were well established in the land by this. I want you to turn to Isaiah 58. And I have a little note here, because in the margin of my Bible, this is the Guy Swenson chapter. And if you have ever attended the camp outreach in Indianapolis, and which it's a great experience. I will recommend it to everyone. It's a wonderful time. But at some point during the week, the guy's going to preach from this chapter. Just giving you a heads up. Just letting you warn you. I almost feel like I'm trespassing. It's like, okay, I'm treading ground here where I don't belong. So, and if guys, I think you're up tomorrow. So if you're planning on using this, I'm sorry. But to be honest, we knew it was coming. So we'll act surprised. Isaiah 58. In verse 1, it says, "Cry loudly, do not hold back. Raise your voice like a trumpet, and declare to my people their transgressions, to the house of Jacob their sins. And they seek me day by day, and delight to know my ways, as a nation that has done righteousness, and has not forsaken the ordinance of their God. They ask me for just decisions. They delight in the nearness of God. Why have we fasted, and you do not see? Why have we humbled ourselves, and you do not notice?" And up until this point, we have the description of a people that it sounds like they're doing all right. You know, it seems like they love God. They were obeying his commandments. They would come to him for decisions. They delighted in his ways. But something was happening. You know, they noticed that, okay, we're praying and fasting for things, and they're not coming. We're not getting the answers, and so they are a little bit worried. But we get an answer to this in the middle of the verse. It says, "Behold, on the day of your fast, you find your desire. And drive hard all of your workers. Behold, you fast for contention and strife, and to strike with a wicked fist. You do not fast like you do today, to make your voice heard on high. Is it a fast like this which I choose, a day for a man to humble himself? Is it for bowing one's head like a reed, and for spreading out sackcloth and ashes as a bed? Will you call this a fast, even an acceptable day of the Lord?" And so we have a people here who are concerned that their prayers were being heard. But he's telling them, you know, you have the wrong motivation behind it. You know, there's something you're missing. You delight in your closeness to God to the point where when you sense that closeness is gone, you get all worried. And then you come to him and you humble yourself. Oh, you know, great and mighty God, what have we done? And so you're concerned when you've lost that connection. But there was something else that they were missing. Their faith was very superficial. They would humble themselves for that connection, but it seems not for anything else. Because it continues in his response, verse 6, "Is this not the fast which I choose? To loosen the bonds of wickedness, to undo the bands of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free and break every yoke. Is it not to divide your bread with the hungry, to bring the homeless poor into the house, when you see the naked to cover him, and not to hide yourself from your own flesh? Then your light will break out like the dawn, and your recovery will speedily bring forth, and your righteousness will go before you, and the glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. Then you will call, and the Lord will answer. You will cry, and he will say, 'Here I am.' If you remove the yoke from your midst, the pointing of the finger, the speaking wickedness, if you give yourself to the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted, then your light will rise in darkness, and your gloom will become as midday. And the Lord will continually guide you and satisfy your desire in the scorched place and give you strength to your bones, and you will be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters do not fail." He was telling them they needed to move beyond protecting their own interest, because they're very good at protecting their own interest. But there was something else. They were, you know, they're supposed to look past, not just obeying God, and not just making sure everything in their own lives are in order. It had to extend farther. Now, in this, God defined the role he was playing. You know, and you could tell I've led up to it. He said, "The Lord will be your rear guard." And do you remember what the rear guard does? The rear guard follows behind, protects the army when it's on the move. The army that is stationary has no use for a rear guard because it's sitting there. It builds up all its defenses. It can protect itself. It's the army on the move, the army that has to go out to protect the borders, the army who sees the enemy coming in there, takes off to meet it. That's the one who needs their back watched. That is the one who God chooses to protect. And the glory of the Lord, that phrase that's used, you know, when the temple was built, in the Holy of Holies, the one is dedicated, there was a cloud that enveloped that area, the Holy of Holies, and the presence of God was there. And there was a cloud that led Israel through the wilderness. And he uses that, you know, that same terminology. It is the glory of the Lord that will follow you, that will protect you. You know, there's a psalm. It says, the angel of the Lord encamps around you to those who fear him and rescues them. And that the Almighty God, his presence, follows you and blesses you and protects you. But you get the feeling here, this is for the army that goes forth. This is for those who put aside their self-interest. They lay aside the instinct to protect themselves at all cost. When you concern yourself with the protection of others, okay, when you just, you know, and anyone can live their own life and, you know, you take care of your own finances, you take care of your own house and all of your own stuff, that's pretty simple. When you go out and say, okay, I'm going to help here, I see a problem in this family, I'm going to go up. When you extend yourself, you make yourself vulnerable. You are fighting a battle. It's a different kind of battle than with armies, and you're engaging a different kind of enemy. But when you do that, you are vulnerable. You know, if you've ever tried to help someone in need, you know, financially, you're putting off a lot of your money. Your time, your energy, you're investing in another person. Emotionally, you know, usually people who need help, they've made some bad choices. And they will probably make some more bad choices. And when we help them, they will continue to make bad choices. You get invested in them, and they may disappoint you. They may take advantage of you. You're vulnerable socially. You know, you help someone who's an addict, people will notice you're going into some bad parts of town, or those people are coming to your house. You know, if you're, you know, what was the accusation given to Jesus? You know, you hang around tax collectors and prostitutes, and, well, that's the reputation. When you go out to help someone, you are vulnerable. You know, I learned a term. This was a couple years ago. I was at work, and we got a call to come back to a job. It was a very large job. We were a very small company, but there was some oversight, and so they had a big meeting of all the head honchos, and we were waiting for the meeting to be done. We had our supervisor inside, and when he came out, he was just fuming. And he was just, and he said something that I didn't understand what it meant. He just said, it's all PYA. And I kind of had to scratch my head, okay. Thought about it for a while. Finally, from context, I figured it out. Nobody there would make a decision. Okay, everybody and all the project managers understood, we had this problem, this oversight, we got to take care of this, it's going to, you know, this is how much it's going to cost, but no one would say, okay, go do it. Because that, well, that's not my department. You know, we have a team of engineers and architects and all sorts of important people, attorneys and accountants that make these decisions, because if anything goes wrong, the blame will fall on that person who said, go do it. So nobody would make the decision. Everybody was protecting their own backside. The first concern was protecting themselves. And when you're in a culture of pointing the finger, it is very difficult to get anything done, because it destroys initiative. It destroys productivity. You know, we have a phrase, I know I've uttered it, no good deed will go unpunished. If you say that every now and then, you know, it seems, I remember one time I was going to a home improvement store, and we had a project. I think we were building a fence in the backyard, so we had to buy a bunch of, you know, the little 6-foot by 6-inch pickets for the fence, and I had several pallets worth. And when I get to the checkout, I look at the bill. It's like, hey, it's a whole lot cheaper than I thought it was going to be. So that's okay. You know, I guess I made a math there. And then I went over the invoice and looked. Instead of charging me for a pallet, they charged me for one picket. It's like, oh, that's a nice little savings. And it took a couple seconds of, they didn't charge me what they should. Maybe a small bit of temptation, but it's okay, no. Okay, I agreed to pay that price. I have no problem with it, so I go, you know, do the right thing, right? So you go to customer service, you show them the invoice, you tell them what the problem is. It took me 2 hours to iron it out. And if you've been in that situation dealing with customer service, you know how it goes. It's either they don't understand the problem, or it's not, they don't have the authority to make that sort of change. We got to wait for the manager to come back on duty, or it's my break. And at some point, you just begin to think, you know, I'm doing this for you. You know, it's not worth my time to save you money. When you try to do the right thing so often, you get grief for it. And it shouldn't be that way, but it is. Often when you try to do the right thing, not only does it not seem worth the effort, it almost seems like it goes unnoticed or unappreciated. And sometimes it seems like you're not changing anything at all. But it's a way of life that we are asked to do, to live. You know, we're given the instructions. We're given the principles of living a godly life. We're told just do them. Keep doing them. And you don't always see the one-on-one relationship of you do good, you get good results from it. And there's actually, there's two examples of this. I want to show you one. It's a direct example of this principle. It's back in Chronicles, 2 Chronicles chapter 16, where we have a king, and he was a good king. And he had trusted God, and God was there for him, and life was good. And then all of a sudden, later on in his life, in his reign, a situation comes up where he gets a little nervous. One of these kings is starting to encroach on him. And he realizes, ooh, we're in a little danger. A little bit of fear creeps up. And so he looks around. He grabs some money from the treasury. He makes a deal with one of his neighbors. You know, he signs a treaty and says, okay, we're going to protect each other. Now, this is something God was not too happy about because he sends a prophet. I want you to turn 2 Chronicles 16, verse 7. It says, at that time, Hanani the seer, he came to Asa the king of Judah, and he said to him, because you have relied on the king of Aram and have not relied on the Lord your God, therefore the army of the king of Aram has escaped out of your hand. Now, were not the Ethiopians and the Lubim an immense army with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he delivered them into your hands. He said, you trusted me in the past. What happened? You know, what changed? If you would have trusted me again, all of these kings would be in your hand. But now, see, now you've made a treaty. Now you have a potential enemy very close to you, and he's going to be there for the end of your reign. It's a very difficult thing to keep on keeping on. You trust God, but sometimes you get worried. Sometimes you see a lot of threats and you're not quite sure. And you look around you and he's not standing next to you physically. And so, well, I got to do the best I can. He trusted God before. Why did he not do so again? You know, and this is interesting because what he said in verse 9, look at that for a minute. It says, for the eyes of the Lord move to and fro throughout the earth, that he may strongly support those whose heart is completely his. You know, God is looking for people he can trust. You know, he's looking for people that will just say, okay, this is a good way to live. We're going to do it. And we're going to do it even when it looks like it's not working, but we trust you. And, you know, how many people out there in their life who they trust God? A lot of them, they aren't even religious. They may not even go to church, but they live a simple life. They know what they were taught in Sunday school. And so they do the very best they can to it. They couldn't quote you any catechism, and they might quote you a couple scriptures. But if they trust him and live their life that way, he says, you know, he's looking for people like that and that he will support them. And then there's this. Turn to Psalm 37. Psalm 37 and verse 23, it says, the steps of a man are established by the Lord, and he delights in his ways. When he falls, he will not be hurled headlong, because the Lord is the one who holds his hand. I have been young, and now I am old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken, or his descendants begging bread. All day long he is gracious and lends, and his descendants are a blessing. Now, when a person is fully engaged in living the godly life, he's honest, he's hardworking, you know, he's gracious, he's compassionate, he's selfless, you know, he does all the things he's supposed to do to be a good neighbor, to be a good citizen. He makes himself vulnerable because there are selfish people out there who know, oh, this is a nice guy, You know, I can ask and borrow his lawnmower, and he's going to say, yeah, sure. And if I move the next day and don't tell him, I can keep that lawnmower. You know, we make ourselves vulnerable when we live that life. But from time to time, even good people, you know, life is going to throw things at you from the ebb and flow of life. You know, you're going to get knocked down on your knees. That's just the way life works. Doesn't mean that you did anything wrong. Just all of us, you're going to fall. You're going to trip. The rug's going to be yanked out from under you. But the promise is, when that happens, yeah, you'll fall. But it's not going to be this devastating, life-changing tragedy. It's no, and I like the way he put this, the Lord is the one that's holding your hand. You may skin your knees. You know, when I read this, the first thing that pops into my head is, you know, you have a toddler. And I haven't had the privilege of raising a child of my own, but I have enough nieces and nephews and family members. I've been there where they're learning to walk. They're standing up and they're shaky. And of course, when they're there, mom and dad is there. One of them's got a little video camera. And they're always hovering around because, you know, trying to walk, it's a challenge. But after a while, they get pretty comfortable. And they can stand up and just by holding one hand out, they can support their weight, and then they start moving on their own. And then, of course, once they're moving around, they're happy about it, and everyone around them is happy about it, until they'll catch a toe. And usually when it happens, you're far enough away. You can see it, but you can't get there. And that happy face, that grin, that exuberance, when that goes right down into the floor, and hopefully you're on carpet, usually you're not. Usually it's hardwood. And all of a sudden it's, and then there's pain, and then there's blood, and there's, you're going to fall. When you learn to walk, you're going to fall. But the promise is, God is going to be there holding your hand. You know, if dad was there when they took that fall, what would happen? Oop. They might skin their knees a little bit. They're not going to have that traumatic face plant. They're not going to have that, you know, that life-changing moment where everything is ruined. It's, when God is holding your hand, those falls don't hurt so bad. You will recover from them. You know, and this is for people who they continue. You know, it says his descendants, he is long and gracious, and his descendants are a blessing. This is a lifelong process for him. He is invested in it. There is trust in God, and it is followed by a promise. Trust him, and he says, and I will always be with you. But we know that the trusting is hard. Because all of us know the story of Job. All of us know when you're faithful, you're going to have a trial. You're going to face a battle. There's going to be some things expected of you that are hard. You know, it's not going to be, you know, an easy road. There's going to be some struggle. We all know that living the godly life, it's not easy. It's hard, and sometimes it's a battle. And that fighting a battle is hard. Not only is it hard work, but even when you win, you know, some of us are, you know, very few of us are Ronda Rousey. We can go into the match and dispatch our enemy like that and walk off without a bruise. Most of us, you get into a match, metaphorically, of course, you're going to take some punches. You're going to take some hits. You're going to get some bruises. You know, God didn't promise an easy life. You know, in fact, when Jesus was talking to his disciples, he gave them a warning. He gave them, and he was trying to prepare them. I want to read something in Luke 21. He was preparing them for some days to come. And it wasn't going to be easy. Now, this was a discussion. It was concerning. They were in Jerusalem, and they were looking at the temple, and they had all these questions that Jesus was answering. And all of a sudden, they got on the topic of the things that were going to happen. I'm going to break into that conversation. And in verse 10, it says, he continued saying to them, nation will rise up against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be great earthquakes, and in various places plagues and famines, and there will be terrors and great signs from heaven. Now, I can imagine if you were at his feet right then, you'd be thinking, ooh, that's what I'm talking about, you're right? Everybody loves a train wreck. The end of days is the biggest train wreck of all. We got famines and earthquakes and pestilence and dogs and cats living together. Oh, all the terrible stuff. He probably had the attention of every man in that room. Ooh, there's a prophet speaking. This, what's going to happen? Now the ears start to tickle. We really want to know. And then he says this. But before all these things, they will lay hands on you, and they will persecute you, delivering you to the synagogues and the prisons, bringing you before kings and governors for my name's sake. It will lead to an opportunity for your testimony. So make up your minds not to prepare beforehand to defend yourselves, for I will give you utterance and wisdom which none of your opponents will be able to resist or refute. But you will be betrayed, even by parents and brothers and relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death. And you will be hated by all because of my name. Yet, not a hair of your head will perish. By your endurance, you will gain your lives. And I can imagine, after listening to that, that was not what I was talking about. That's tough. You know, we just want to live our lives. You know, who wants to be the hero? Who wants to be the great leader? Most of us, you know, I just want to grow up. You get married, have a decent job, have some kids, have a good family life, be a good neighbor, live in peace, a little bit of a prosperity, you know, have enough that, you know, you can retire on comfortably. But we don't need to be prophets. We don't need to, you know, to be world changers. Most of us, we just, you know, I just want to believe. Just want to believe, just want to trust. Yeah, you know, there's some obligations. Help the needy. Spread the gospel a little bit. But he's asking, or he's telling them, this is going to be tough. There's going to be some battles ahead. He was giving them a warning. If you live a Christ-centered life, there are going to be confrontations. You know, if you live in a world where everyone pursues their own self-interest, you live in a world where everyone's looking to blame somebody else, you're going to have a conflict. You're going to butt up right up against that. It's inevitable. People will notice you. You can't help it. Ask Tim Tebow. People know you're a Christian. They're going to take notice. And everything you do, someone's going to be looking and watching and judging. You know, some, you know, may actually be taken up in front of a magistrate. I think for most of us, our trial, we probably won't even know what's going on. Someone, a neighbor, a coworker, you call yourselves a Christian, and they take notice, so they watch you. And whether we know it, they judge us. And whether we know it, we are witnessing to them. And whether that's a good witness or a bad witness, that all depends on how we do. Now, it may feel like, you know, reading this, that we're being, you know, when we're going through this trial, we're being betrayed. You know, we are abandoned. We're stuck. And if you've ever been in a situation where it just seems the whole world is against you, and it's like you pray about it and like, what is happening? You know, I just feel so, you know, all the guns are pointed at me. But he says, I'll be there. I'll give you the words. I'll give you the comfort and the strength and the courage. Now, you could walk out of here today and you could say, man, that was the best sermon I ever heard. It was inspiring. It was insightful. It was funny. Oh, it really could happen. I'm not saying it is, but it really could happen. But even if that were the case, you know, what good does that do us? Because, you know what we're doing here today? We like to think we're preaching the gospel now. We're preaching to the choir. You know, most of us here, we're well familiar with the gospel message. And, you know, it's a good thing for the camaraderie, for the encouragement to stand, you know, to lift each other up. You know, it's not a bad thing at all. But the ones who don't have the message, the ones who really need the gospel, you know, they're out that door. You know, there's years ago when we were meeting one of our church halls, it was in the Sunday school room of a Baptist church. Yeah, their Sunday school class was much bigger than our whole congregation. But I did like when you left the main hall, there were words above the door that said, you are now entering the mission field. If you were to leave here today and you took this word and you read it, you believed it, you trusted it, you applied it to your life, and then even when life was just killing you, even when it just didn't seem like it was working, you just did it. You believed it. You trusted it. That would be the best sermon a man can give. Because people will watch. People notice. It was something Jesus was trying to teach his disciples. They were going to be living testimonies to that gospel. Now, did you notice that there was a paradox in the passage we just read? Verse 16, I believe, it says, "And they will put some of you to death." And then you go to verse 18, it says, "Not a hair of your head will perish." You might scratch your head, okay, well, going to believe you, God, but you just said some of us might be put to death. You know, and it is a head-scratcher, but every war has its casualties, you know, and every battle has its cost. And if you look through just, you know, the United States and our military history, we've won most of the wars we've been in, and even the ones we win decisively. You know, we have soldiers that don't come home. We have good men, and today good women, who go out there and they lose their life, even in a victory. You know, that is the cost of war. That is the price of battle. But as much as we trust that God will protect us, the history of our church, of the church in general, is filled with the blood of martyrs. We know people have given their lives. We know sometimes, you know, it was brought up in an earlier sermon with Michael Dearing in India. We know that there are people in the world today that just claiming Christ as their Lord and Savior is enough, if not to destroy their life, maybe even take their life. It's a price people have paid, and boy, aren't we blessed to not have to face that. And I do wonder sometimes, well, what would I do? You know, what would I do if I was in that room and I had that crazed terrorist with the blade and the sword and telling me to, you know, cast off your beliefs, deny your Lord. There's a scene I think we're all familiar with. We've all watched it or we've read it, you know, in our favorite book, in our favorite movie. The hero is being chased and the army, the enemy is chasing them and there's no room for escape and they know they're going to be caught. And then there's a moment where somebody in his company, usually it's the warrior, usually it's a grizzled veteran, and he looks around and he says, you know, this is a good place to make a stand. And so he tells them his plan. He's going to stay there. He's going to defend that pass, that door, that hallway, whatever it is, and he's going to let the hero escape because this battle is too important. You know, this is more important than me. And he knows. He knows if he stays and he fights, he will probably die. And there's all the emotion and all the teariness, and for some of us, it's the favorite part of the book. But it's a choice he makes. This is a good place to make my stand. This is a place where my life would be well spent. There was a quote I found, and it was attributed to Martin Luther King, and for the life of me, I cannot find the source. So if anyone knows where this came from, please tell me. And if it doesn't come from anywhere, well, then it came from me. Because it goes like this. A good life contains at least one thing that you would be willing to die for. You know, it's healthy to have an interest outside of yourself. You know, for most of us, if you're a parent, you understand, you put your kids right up there. You know, if you're married, hopefully you put your spouse right up there. This is, if danger comes your way, you would put yourself in that path of danger, give your life to protect your family. But, you know, even beyond your own personal interests, it's healthy to have interest outside of yourself, outside of your own little realm. You know, an issue or cause that's bigger than your own life, something you pour your energy into, you pour your passion into. You know, you try to make a difference because you know it's bigger than just me. This is important. You know, this is something that can make a difference in the lives of others. And a time may come when we realize, you know, this battle's too important. I've been at this for 50 years and haven't made any difference at all. And there's a moment when you can back up and retreat again, or you can stand your ground and say, nope, I'm not moving. It's too big. This is too important. And if it costs my life, well, then it costs my life. Death, you know, that's an enemy that dogs all of us sooner or later. We know we're not living forever, at least not in this flesh. And I think there's a mercy there that God gives us that sometimes he allows us to face it at our own terms. And, you know, I think going back to that paradox, some of us will be put to death, but some of us, not a hair in our head, is going to be harmed. You know, and I think the answer to that is something that was brought up in an earlier sermon. I really do think there's free will involved. You know, I think we face trials, and when it's too much and we cry out, I can't do this anymore, God is merciful. He makes a way of escape. We retreat. We live to fight again. But I also think when we decide, you know, this is where I'm going to make my stand. I've been doing this too long. I've been retreating too long. And if the enemy wants this ground, it's going to have to come through me. And I think God respects that. Okay, you want to do this? I'll back you up. You know, there was a moment where Paul, before he was on his way to Jerusalem, this was his final journey to Jerusalem, and he was with a lot of his friends and saying goodbye, and a prophet came to him and basically told him, you continue on this journey. It's going to come to no good end. He was warning them ahead of time. You go this route, you will probably be arrested. You know, there's a lot of symbolism of binding his arms and all this, but Paul knew. He understood that if he went, this might be the last thing he does, and he was good with it. He says, you know, if it costs me my life, then it costs me my life. He was at that stage in his life where it's like, I've done this too long. I'm tired of backing down. I want you to finish this verse for me. Greater love has no man than this. You know, I think God gives us that option. The heroic life is there. If you want to go for it, he's there to back you up. If it's too much, he'll find a way out. Now, Paul wasn't there for that explanation that Jesus gave. He came a little bit later, but he did understand the cost it took, or the cost you paid to trust God. I want to turn to something he wrote to the Corinthians. 2 Corinthians and in chapter 4. So in verse 1, it says, therefore, since we have this ministry, as we have received mercy, we do not lose heart. But we have renounced the things hidden because of shame, not walking in craftiness or adulterating the word of God, but by manifesting the truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. And then verse 3 says, even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, in whose case the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelieving, so that they may not see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is in the image of God. For we do not preach ourselves, but Christ Jesus as Lord, and ourselves as your bondservants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, light shall shine out of darkness, is the one who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. And, you know, for any of you who have tried to talk to, if you wish to say, someone in the world, they don't see God. You know, we can look into nature and we can just look at, wow, you know, just the wonders of God's creation. And it touches us. And it's just amazing to try to fathom what he did and how he did it. When the world looks at nature, you know, they can look at down to the very cells that life is made of. They can look out into the far reaches of the universe, go back billions of years in time. They just wonder how it all got here by itself. You know, they don't see God. Something has been veiled from them. They don't see God in religion. You know, to them, God is an intellectual discussion. You know, to them, that's something that, you know, high-minded people in ivory towers discuss. God is a political argument. You know, God is something that you blue-collar folk, you know, over the table drinking beer argue over, you know, something that you can be passionate about, something that's divisive, something that there is no real right answer. Just whoever shouts the loudest is right. Kind of like which college football team is the best. But see if we're still on. There we go. God is a myth to them. God is something that, you know, we use a tool to explain the unexplainable. Or it's a tradition, something we've done for so long, we don't know why, but we just do, we just believe in it. Or it's a delusion, something a lie we tell ourselves in order to give us some hope and some promise. some purpose in our lives. They can't see it. They cannot see God. God reveals himself openly, not to them, but to those who put aside their self-interest and search for him with humble hearts. We would wish, wouldn't God just come down now, make yourself manifest, show everyone who you are? But he doesn't. He makes you work for it. You search for him. And the world has a hard time comprehending people who are not motivated by self-interest. That's not how evolution works. All of us are trying to, are selfish in some way. They just don't get it. But in verse 7, this revelation, this knowledge, however you want to put it, this understanding, the fact that you can see and understand God, it's a treasure in earthen vessels. This is supreme eternal knowledge, and here we are, flesh and blood, comprehending it. So that the surpassing greatness of the power will be of God and not from ourselves. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. We are perplexed, but not despairing. We are persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may be manifested in our body. For we who live are constantly being delivered over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus may be manifested in our mortal flesh. Now, boy, I know that can get, and Paul can get some tongue twisters there trying to follow him. But when you decide to live your life in the manner prescribed in Scripture, when you turn the other cheek, when you go the extra mile, when you pray for your enemies, when you're striving in your life, provide for the needy, protect the weak, heal the wounded, it's a battle. You'll be afflicted. You'll be confused, perplexed. You'll be persecuted. It almost feels like you're swimming upstream sometimes. You ever tried to swim upstream? It's exhausting. You just put in all your energy, and then the moment you rest, all that ground you gain just passes you by. And it seems futile. It seems like you're not making a difference at all. But when you realize it's not a battle we were expecting to win. When we're told to live this way, we're not changing the flesh. We're not changing this body. We're not changing this world. It is what it is. This world is the battlefield. This world is the arena in which we go through this scene, this play, this story. And however you see the great enemy, it could be sin. Some see it as the devil. Some see it as death. However you see it, the story you're told, the promise you're given, Christ has dealt with it. He's already defeated it. That was the promise. I will engage the enemy. I'll go out there. I'll battle the enemy. Your job is to go forward, to keep moving. Our role is to be the living testimony for that victory. The lives we live, they focus in on what he did and how he did it. How many times have we missed out on the miracle in our life because we wouldn't go forward? What was the last thing? Israel... they faced an army behind them and the sea in front of them. And we are going to face something different. It's not going to be the exact same as them. For us, it might be cancer. It might be bankruptcy. It might be divorce or addiction or disability or whatever it is that this life has to throw at us that just, knocks us to our knees, that makes us doubt, that overwhelms us. And, when it hits us, we get confused. We get overwhelmed. We get afraid. And the instinct is, trust God. He'll take care of it. Hopefully. But usually what happens is, we hunker down. We put up our defenses. We dig the trench. We build the moat around us. We put up the fortifications. We'll isolate ourselves from everyone else who's telling us, no, we're there. God will help you. He'll be there. Trust him. We want to, but when you're overwhelmed, when you can't see your salvation, it's easy to just stay put, start defending yourself. How many times when God was listening to our prayers, he thought, son, don't be afraid. I'll be there. I've got your back. Just keep moving forward, and then you'll see what I can do. You know, it was mentioned in another sermon about counting our blessings and reminded of that, and that's a good thing, and certainly it's encouraging, but I want to focus on something else, not just counting our blessings, but realizing how privileged we are, the position that we hold. You know, I'm confident Abraham did not feel privileged. You know, I read the account. You know, he was told one day, go grab your son, go over to that mountain, and offer him as a sacrifice. I'm sure he was a little confused, concerned, perplexed, maybe a little fearful, possibly overwhelmed. But he went forward. He just kept doing it. This is what God said. I don't understand it, and I'm trying to get in his head. I understand. You know, in hindsight, he was the living embodiment of John 3:16, wasn't he? You know, he lived what that verse was saying. He offered his son as a sacrifice. And when God stayed his hand at the very end, what did he say? He said, now I know. You know, there's something about when you have lived that gospel message. You know, when it's part of your life. It's not just something, a words to believe or to say. When you've lived it and you've come out the other side, there's no doubt where your heart is. The gospel message is not an intellectual discussion. It's not just something two theologians discuss one day trying to figure out the meaning of life. It's not a math problem to be figured out. It's not an argument to be won. It's visceral. It's flesh and bone and blood and sweat and tears. Sometimes it's sorrow and it's grief and it's pain, but it's also joy and it's also love and hope. It's the story of life from death. And when we face tragedy, when we face loss, when we face pain and grief, and we do it, yeah, those are tough days. But when we do it with the confidence that, you know, I'm going to keep going forward. There is abundant life ahead of me. What has happened behind me, he's promised to take care of that. I don't need to watch my back. I don't need to turn around. He's got my back. I'm going to keep going forward. When we do so with joy and hope and confidence, we are living embodiments of that gospel message. And people will see. That is the best sermon you can give, you know. And when I say it's a privilege, it's, you know, God leaves open that opportunity to have a heroic life. He leaves open that opportunity to walk in the footsteps of his son, to be sons and daughters. Now, we know how that sounds on paper, and we think one day, yes, it would be great to be sons and daughters of God, but he's giving us the opportunity to do it right here now. To walk in those footsteps. It's a privilege to be called a brother or sister in Christ. Because when the world is exposed to the gospel, remember, they don't see God. You know, they hear this message, they look at this scripture, they've had it for over 1,000 years. They don't see God. They can't. Their eyes are closed. Whether they've closed it or God closed it, either way. They don't see God. They can't see it, touch it, taste it, feel it, measure it. When the world is exposed to the gospel, they don't see God. They see us.